Case number 21778, Desmond Ricks, David Potch, et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Mazaron, you may proceed for the appellant.
May it please the court, Mary Mazaron on behalf of the defendants appellees, officers Potch, Stariez, and Wilson. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. The city officers bring this qualified immunity appeal because they're entitled to reversal and judgment in their favor based on the absence of clearly established law that would have told them that less than intentional conduct could be the basis for a fabrication of evidence claim, or that a mistaken analysis and report without more could be the basis for a fabrication.
Why do you say less than intentional conduct?
Pardon me?
Why do you say less than intentional conduct?
Because the district court articulated in its ruling a standard that was intentional or reckless, and the proofs that the district court relied upon all were given, the testimony was all, either it was intentional or it was a horrible mistake. And that's throughout, every single expert offered that kind of dichotomy, and in that circumstance...
Did they use the word fabrication at some point?
Did the district court?
Doesn't the record evidence use words like fabrication? That's not reckless.
I think the record evidence of the experts, when asked about what happened, I don't think they said fabricated. I think that when they analyzed the report, and forgive me if I'm misremembering, but my understanding of the record is they repeatedly said either it was intentional conduct or it was horrible, and they concluded based on the fact that two experts mistakenly concluded that the bullets could have been used in the Rossi gun, they concluded that, therefore, it was either a horrible mistake or
intentional.
Intentional.
Intentional, you lose. Horrible mistake, maybe you win.
Correct.
And there's evidence to at least support a theory that it was intentional.
I don't think there is, and I think there's a whole line of cases that talks about why that is the case. What the cases have said is that when you're looking at a mistaken report or a mistaken analysis, even if it's horribly mistaken, that alone is not enough, and certainly in terms of the law from this circuit and I think throughout the country, to conclude that somebody has engaged in intentional conduct. And that's properly so.
But why couldn't a jury look at this evidence and decide it was intentional?
Because there's nothing other than an unreasonable, speculative basis.
Well, I mean, you're the one that just kept saying there's lots of evidence about intentional or reckless, intentional or reckless, intentional or reckless. Okay, let's assume you're right, that reckless doesn't count. The inferences go the way of the plaintiffs. Why can't a jury say we're voting intentional?
If you look at the clearly established law about fabrication, and you look at a whole series of cases, those cases where this court concluded it was enough to avoid immunity or to get to a jury on a fabrication claim included more than just the mistaken outcome. So if you look at Gregory, for example, the investigator counted 7 hairs. Her notes had the number 7 scratched out. She indicated other results were inconclusive. So there was affirmative evidence beyond just the mistake to show that she engaged in intentional fabrication.
Is there a theory here that the test bullets were given to the expert, the examiner, the first time around? Isn't that the theory?
There is a theory that Stariez switched the bullets. And again, that's entirely speculative based on...
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what you mean by... I mean, it's not proven yet. But it doesn't seem like wildly speculative. I mean, this seems like a I'm not an expert on ballistics, but it seems like this is something that you could
detect. I'm an expert on rifling.
Nor that. But it seems like this is something that someone could detect who's specified in this area, and that it would be unusual to make such a wild mistake, and that could be reckless or intentional. I mean, there's at least a plausible theory that some evidence to support. Even your expert was pretty wobbly on the point, right?
Well, what you have is trial testimony from 20 years ago or whatever the exact numbers are that the experts in this case have all agreed was wrong. And I'm not disputing that. It was wrong. But under the clearly established law of this circuit, you have to show intentional. And under the clearly established law of this circuit, just because you have a really big mistake isn't enough. And in Caminetta, in Gregory, in all of those cases, you had some evidentiary basis beyond the big mistake, if you want to call it that, which would allow a reasonable inference, a reasonable jury, to take the next step. And that's absent here.
So this is what I'm having a hard time processing, so maybe I'm just missing it. I mean, this is a hypothetical, but it's close to the facts. So you have bullet from victim, and the bullet from victim supposedly has 5 rifling marks. And then you have this other bullet, the 6 rifling marks, and that's the one that comes from the defendant's gun. All right? And then the experts say, I wasn't there. Like, I don't know what in the world this person was doing. But I see 2 possibilities. They're idiots, or they intentionally changed the evidence. They can't say anything more. That they would be lying if they said anything more. And it's still very relevant evidence, and the jury would then make a decision based on what they'd heard and everything else. And they could decide it was intentional. And intentional surely satisfies the clearly established law.
If it were to be that, that would be the case. But I don't think...
I'm right how I'm thinking about it. I'm just wrong about the facts here.
Well, wrong about what the law has said about what it takes to show intentionality. I'm trying to frame it in legal terms.
What did I get wrong with my hypothetical? My hypothetical, it seems to me, would get to a jury and they would have authority to say, on this evidence, we think there's, you know, preponderance that it was intentional. They intentionally switched out the evidence. Why couldn't they do that with what I just described? And I admire the expert that didn't say it was intentional. How does the expert know it was intentional? They don't.
So I would say 2 things. First, it is the law, and I would cite Bishop v. Hackle, and I would cite the Turner case, that if you have nothing more than an unreasonable inference, that is an inference that's not logically deducible in one direction from the facts, that is sufficient to reverse the denial of summary disposition or summary judgment.
So your point is unreasonable to infer that this was intentional.
Correct. And then...
If we disagree with that, then...
Well, I would add to that, I'm hoping you won't disagree, but I understand the questions. I would add to that, this court's case law has said, and not only this court, but the circuits from around the country have said that just having a really mistaken analysis in and of itself is not enough. You have to show that the person knew that they were mistaken, and they nevertheless presented this fabricated suppression or creation of evidence. And that's absent here.
I mean, I guess you could get that if the officer admitted, yep, you're right, I fabricated it. But sure, the officer admitting that, what more evidence are you going to have here other than the bullets? And you have the actual bullets, you have the testing. I'm just not sure what more you would have other than someone admitting
that. How about this as a variation on a hypo? The victim dies from a rifle, and the only bullets they have are shotgun shells. Is that enough to show intent?
Well,
the expert doesn't know what happened. He doesn't know how the bullet, the rifle bullet disappeared and they have shotgun shells.
Right.
They know what happened. So he says, this person's blind, or this person intentionally fabricated, or this person's something strange going on. And that goes to a jury, doesn't it?
Your hypothetical is there's one kind of bullet, shotgun shell. And
the victim dies from a rifle bullet. One.
Okay, one rifle.
The only evidence they have 20 years later are shotgun shells.
And the claim is against the person who gave testimony that it was the one and not the other.
Yeah.
Wrongly? There may be. I mean, that's an extreme hypothetical. I don't think that would be a closer call. It may be that the court would go the other way. But that's not what this evidence shows. I mean, in fact, Townsend gave testimony at the trial. He was the key witness who gave this testimony at the trial. He looked at the bullets. He talked about all these things. And then 20 years later, when they no longer have the gun and they have different evidence, they all reach a conclusion, wow, this was really a bad mistake. Good that they figured this out because Mr. Ricks is no longer in prison. But that isn't the same thing as concluding that there is a jury submissible case and that these officers are not entitled to the protection of qualified immunity. You asked, I see my time is up. I'm really hoping I could just make
quick
points, very quick. One is, there are cases where there is evidence. Gregory is an example of that. I think Ferris is an example of that, where there's more than just the mistake, where somebody scratched something out and deliberately omitted, but there's evidence they knew it existed in the documentation.
Okay.
And that would certainly...
Is that your first and second? Or
the second is... Stelias was not even there in the testing. The district court, nevertheless, refused to dismiss that theory against him, said he could be held liable both on the testing and the so-called switching bullets.
You think he should get relief on the testing because he wasn't there, but if you're otherwise wrong, he's still in the case when it comes to the switching?
He should get relief.
I know you want him to have relief 100%.
But no,
I'm
understand.
Asking it in the context of your point.
What I was going to
that he wasn't at the test, which would have nothing to do with the switching.
Correct.
Okay. Good.
Correct.
Right.
And I would say, with respect to the switching, I don't know any law.
You're going to get rebuttal. Rebuttal's good.
Okay.
On to point four, or five, or six. All right, here we go.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Seema Patel on behalf of plaintiffs. At counsel table with me, I have our partner, James Harrington, and our appellate associate, Kirsten Nunn, with me today. Your Honors, this case is, Mr. Ricks was wrongfully imprisoned for almost 25 years based on fabricated evidence, and that evidence was fabricated by the defendants in this case. Now,
why do you want a delay in the Court of Appeals saying you're right? Your Johnson versus Jones argument, delays are having views on any of this stuff. So you want us to dismiss the appeal for lack of jurisdiction as opposed to getting an appellate ruling that there's a triable issue of fact, which, by the way, means if you win in the jury trial, there'd be no grounds for reversal because we would have already said there's a triable issue of fact.
Well, I was
trying. So why push Johnson versus Jones? I've never understood this.
I was trying to parse out defendants' argument. So the way they've presented the briefing, it seems like they're accepting all of our facts in a plaintiff favorable way that they're supposed to as the non-moving party. We're supposed to have all inferences.
All you have to do is remind us of the Rule 56 standard.
Okay.
And if we understand the Rule 56 standards, which I certainly hope we do after all these cases under Rule 56, that means if you get a ruling in your favor that there's a triable issue of fact and you win in front of the jury, you've got a precedent, lock, stock, barrel.
That's
right. It's not appeal. There's really no appeal.
And I will concede the dismissal on the jurisdictional basis. I just wanted to cover that ground because it seemed like, in an oblique way, that defendants were trying to argue the facts and re-argue the facts. But I agree that we're under Rule 56 standard. all reasonable inferences must be made in favor of us as the non-moving party. I think they're conflating a reasonable inference in this case with speculation. Anything that can be considered a reasonable inference, defendants are trying to label as a speculation. The facts in this case are horrific, and I think that the timeline is significant. Mr. Ricks was arrested before the gun was recovered and before the ballistics examination was conducted by Wilson and Polk. After the gun was recovered at his house, the lead investigator, Sawix, asked for in the normal course of things, for the investigation to occur. And that's when Polk did his initial investigation of the ballistics. Now, that investigative report, I think, is very significant. It's a single one-page report. It's conclusory. It identifies the two evidence bullets. It states that there are traces of lands and grooves, and then it concludes that there's a positive, 100% positive ID match with the gun that was found at Mr. Ricks' house, the Rossi 38. Now, that report is significant also in light of Polk's trial testimony at the Ricks trial, because at the trial testimony, I think we quoted this in part in our briefing, but Polk went through and he explained to the jury the significance of lands and grooves. He explained the significance of the science behind ballistics matching and why certain guns and certain bullets can be matched. And he explained why these bullets, 100%, like a fingerprint, came out of this gun. And in doing so, he explained the importance of lands and grooves and why, because certain guns have rifling characteristics inside of them, those grooves and lands also form corresponding grooves.
I want to hear your response to the other side's argument, which I take to be this. So maybe I'm doing it on a hypothetical to make it more stark. But I think what she's saying is, you know, plaintiffs lose in a case where hypothetically all you have is this evidence. There's a disparity. Okay, there's something that seemed to go wrong here. And the only evidence, we'll just say there's one expert to make it simple, and the expert says, I have no idea what happened. This was either a mistake, innocent mistake, or someone was playing games, switching things out, fabricating. So I think what she's saying is listen, unless someone says this is evidence of fabrication, this is evidence of intentionality, you can't get to a jury. The or is what creates the problem. So I think that's her main pitch.
I think that is her main pitch, and I think she's absolutely wrong, because that takes what should be a reasonable inference into the only way that you can ever get any justice in court is if you have an affirmative confession by the defendant. But I do want to also add that we have more than that in this case.
Qualified immunity is designed to help the other side. I'm not sure. Right? It's supposed to be pretty egregious stuff when officers are found monetarily liable, right?
It is, but what happened in this case is also egregious, and it actually, whatever is beyond egregious.
But my example is negligence or intentionality. That's a big difference, because you would agree negligence means it's not a problem.
I don't think it's negligence. I think it's gross incompetence and negligence, and I think that...
What's a case that shows she's wrong? I share your instinct that she's wrong about that, that it's an honest expert that says, I don't know because I wasn't there. All I can tell you is how unusual this is. But what's a case that says, when the honest expert says it's one or the other, and one of the options is not enough, hypothetically, what's the case that says, boy, you let the jury decide?
Well, I think the Gregory case went to that, right? Okay. Because the examiner in that case, Katz, kept saying, well, I just made a mistake. I didn't see these, or I kept these off. And yes, there was other evidence that said that maybe she could or didn't. But you're never going to have a defendant who's going to come and say, yes, I made a mistake, or I intentionally left something out. They're always going to say, I made a mistake. They're never going to admit that they falsified evidence in order to secure a false conviction. And so Gregory, I think that the Bernard v. Mills case goes into it a little bit. I know we did it in Maldowan a little bit. It's all talking about how you build up the evidentiary basis. From this evidence, what is a reasonable inference from there? And Your Honor, I think that's what it comes down to. And here, we don't just have negligence. I don't think a single one of the experts, not the examiners themselves, not the defense expert, not any of our experts, nobody said that this was in the realm of just negligence. This was either gross incompetence or intentional. It couldn't be both. And the second piece of evidence that I want to tie into, which is, I think, significant in considering all of this, is that Polk's trial testimony that I was talking about a minute ago. In his trial testimony, he stated that he understood the significance of lands and grooves. He understood that a gun that is a 6R designation, it has 6 lands and grooves, will only be able to fire a bullet that also has corresponding 6 lands and grooves. He understood this. In his report, he stated that the two bullets had trace lands and grooves. That's how he designated that in the report. In his trial testimony, he also stated that you need to be able to match up. It's basically fitting a puzzle piece together, that the two have to match in order to make a positive identification. But then years later, in 2017, when we're taking his deposition, he's changed his story. In his deposition, he's saying, well, I couldn't make out any lands and grooves. I just saw traces. I couldn't make a positive ID as to whether something was a left 5R gun, or I mean 5R bullet, or 6R, right? He's very unequivocal about all that. But then he ends that with, but regardless of the fact that I can't make out that this is a 6R bullet or a 5R bullet, I can still say that this was a positive identification. Now, after he's gone through the step of explaining, I understand that the methodology is unassailable. No one of the experts, or even the two examiners involved, the defendant examiners, nobody disagrees that this is the methodology involved with making a positive identification of the bullets. So he agrees with that. Then he agrees and admits in the deposition that all he was able to see were traces of lands and grooves, and that based on his examination, he's saying he couldn't make out whether it was a 5R or a 6R. Well, that's a basic rifling characteristic. Before you can make a positive identification, you have to go through detailed steps to make sure that there are overall class identified markers that are met, sub-identifiers that are met, and then go to the very specifics that are to that specific gun. He couldn't even do that. He said he could not tell whether this was a 6R or a 5R bullet. But then he also stated that he could make a positive ID. That's intentional conduct right there. He's admitting that he knows the methodology, that this statement saying that a 5R and a 6R can come from the same gun is wrong, but then he's still espousing the conclusion that that was a positive ID, and that's intentional. I don't think that there is, I personally don't believe that there's any other inference from that.
Can I ask you about the point your friend on the other side made near the end of her argument about, I don't know how to pronounce the name, but that officer was denied qualified immunity with respect to the testing, although that officer wasn't there, I think. At least there is their theory for the testing, and so that the district court was at least wrong on that part of the case.
I think the district court had a blip misstatement in the recitation of the record in the 78-page opinion that it issued. It comes from our allegations in the complaint, and so I think way back before discovery, et cetera, when the complaint was being written, we alleged that Stalitz was present during that investigation. Discovery has shown that he wasn't, and we were not arguing that, but our fabrication claim against Stalitz isn't dependent on that. I think what defendants are actually asking is for that allegation to be stricken from the complaint, and so it doesn't form the basis of the fabrication claim. If you look at the complaint, there's just one fabrication count that applies to all defendants. So there isn't like two separate fabrication counts pleaded against Stalitz, one based on being present at the investigation and one based on switching the bullets en route. There's just the one fabrication claim against him, and we have facts that support that. I don't mind that being clarified, because I think that was played out in our statement. I think that one other point that I did want to talk about, and I did talk about it a little bit in detail about Polk's report and the detail or lack thereof in the report and his trial testimony, but defendants rely a lot on Caminata, which also involved a report, albeit in arson. I think that analysis and juxtaposition between the two is important because the report in Caminata was detailed. It had explained methodology. It had numerous pictures attached to it. I think Chief Judge Sutton, you presided over that case, so you know a little bit more about it. But that is not the scenario that we have in this case at all. Also in Caminata, the experts involved, there was a difference of opinion in methodology, and the plaintiff's expert were impugning the methodology used by the defendant, but they didn't come right out and say, this is right and this is wrong. Here, even defendants are not disputing the methodology involved with making a positive identification. Everybody agrees that this is the way it's done, and if you don't meet that first class characteristic match, that's a process of elimination. You can't make a positive ID. And I think that...
So pretend we're the jury. What are you going to say in your closing argument if this goes back to a jury to get to the intentionality? Are you going to say these are just really, really bad people from the beginning and just playing games, or just gross, gross recklessness and zealousness about wanting to prosecute? I mean, juries want to know why things happened. What are you going to say?
Well, Your Honor, I am an appellate practitioner, so it's very different than
being
a trial.
This will be fun.
Right? Right. But I think that the story that comes out, and when I see the timeline, it's important because Mr. Ricks was arrested. They thought they had their man. They went and got the gun that they found at his mother's house.
Confirmation bias type problem?
Yeah, and then they go and they do the testing, and they're like, well, we're going to make the bullets fit.
And they see something that's not really there.
Yeah, well, maybe see something that's not there. I think it goes one step further, and it does go into misfeasance of we're going to make the bullets fit. We're going to make this evidence fit into our theory of the case and our theory of what happened. And I think, I mean, pulling into Stavix, it's we don't know why, but all of a sudden, instead of having the bullets reexamined by Mr. Townsend at the DPD crime lab, they were transported by Stavix to Mason, Michigan, which was almost 100 miles away from Detroit, and done at his lab. The evidence bullets were not kept in any sealed envelope that had like plastic or whatever. They were kept in brown manila folders that were closed with a string tie. He had the means, motive, and opportunity to switch out the bullets. All he had to do was open the envelope, take out those bullets, the evidence bullets, put in the test bullets, and then when Mr. Townsend does his testing, you know, he's testing the Rossi revolver with test bullets that had earlier come out of the Rossi revolver. So he's going to show a positive ID. I think that this was a case where it was a gross miscarriage of justice, and that the DPD and the officers involved in this case abused their power and made the evidence fit their theory of the case and wrongfully imprisoned a man and stole 25 years of his life. So, any other questions?
I think we're set. Thank you.
Thank you.
Masseron, you have your 4 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, and I have about 4 points to make. First of all, Sister Counsel has conceded the need for clarification with respect to the testing.
Yeah.
Second, with respect to Stelias, there's no law that I'm aware of from the U.S. Supreme Court or this circuit that says merely because somebody has the means and opportunity to switch evidence or to do some act that would result in a constitutional violation, that's enough to get to a jury. And that is absolutely all that there is. That's what the district court said there was in this case, based on a whole long line of cases, Bishop and Turner and others. This court has said it has to be a reasonable inference, and I would submit there is no reasonable inference with respect to the switching of the bullets. Um, unless that same reasonable inference could be used at all of the multiple people who had access to the property room, et cetera, et cetera. And that's very clear in the record in the district court opinion. The next point I'd like to make is with respect to an intentional or mistaken conduct and the idea of speculative, your question with respect to confirmation bias, I think is a good reminder. What you have here is a testing which the Pouch's notes reflect difficulty with reading Lands and Grooves. He only could find traces, and in fact, Molnar, who was an expert who testified years later, had the same problem. He looked, he said, I can't figure it out, I don't know. They said, go back, look again. And then when he looked again with additional microscopes and so forth, he came to a conclusion. That, I think, supports the notion that we're talking about a mistake, a terrible mistake, but there's...
But that's not, like, based on a technological development. It's, you know...
I'm not arguing that there was no negligence, that a competent investigator might have come to a different, should have come to a different outcome. What I'm saying, though, is there's nothing here to go from that notion that that report was wrong, badly wrong, to the notion that the officers engaged, knew it was wrong, and deliberately put it forward. And I think if the Caminata case and the Ferris case both make the point that Gregory is not to be read for the notion that any time you have a mistake in analysis, that is enough to get beyond qualified immunity and get to a jury. And I don't think it is, nor do I think it should be here. In the Mills case and the Gregory case, both show it is possible to have a jury submissible case, but what it requires is some additional proofs. In both of those cases, there were additional proofs. There was the investigator scratching out the number, reporting only 5 hairs instead of 7 in the one, and there was DNA testing and the number of different DNAs that the investigator's notes revealed, but that her report failed to deliberately include such that the outcome was deliberately fabricated. That's different from what the evidence shows here. And the last point is simply with respect to the duplicative Brady claim. I think it's very important that even if the court doesn't agree, and especially if the court doesn't agree on the other claims, that claims be narrowed when cases are going to trial. And in this case, it wouldn't be true in every Brady case, but in this case, the evidence for the Brady claim, the theory of the Brady claim, is exactly the same as the other claims, and it should be dismissed as a duplicative claim.
Okay.
I'm happy to. Thank you for your time.
Both of you for your helpful briefs and oral arguments and for answering our questions. As always, we appreciate it. Thanks so much. The case will be submitted and the